The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
Welcome to the EMS Educast, the EMS World Expo pre-show edition. This is co-host Greg Fries. Rob Terrio and Bill Toon are not participating in this episode. They both said something about having some sort of superhero-type duties they needed to complete, so I wish them the best on doing those things. But in their place, I'm very, very happy to introduce what very well could be sometime the future co-hosts of the EMS Educast. I've got previous visitors and guests, David Blevins, Kevin Colopy, and Brian Lilly. You guys just say the word, and I think we'd hand the whole thing over to you guys. How does that sound?
Sounds like an absolute disaster, Greg.
I think my boss would kill me if he thought for a second I was taking on any more work right now.
And I think the ratings just hit the floor when you said that. But hey, we'll rock with it. Whatever you want to.
The three of you guys leave me just hanging in the balance there. I put that out there with so much hopefulness and optimism and. Straight we go into the earth. We just augured in there. So maybe I'll have to continue my search for my replacement. So listeners, if you've got an inkling for being part of the award-winning EMS Educast, arguably maybe the second longest-running EMS type podcast available on the internet, I think Jamie Davis and the Medicast is the only other podcast that's longer running and maybe also has more episodes than we have. If you want to be part of this great endeavor, it doesn't take much. We don't need a resume. Email of interest would suffice. Obviously, some background in EMS education would be helpful as well. But, Brian and David and Kevin, their resumes are pretty thin, so you could probably be part of this as well.
It's tough love tonight on EMS Educast.
It sure is. Brian, I actually kid. I've been reading a lot of this parody blog, Call the Cops.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm constantly – I actually used to read a lot of The Onion, so I was always sort of thinking about – how I could restart a career as a headline writer for The Onion. And then when Call the Cops appeared on my internet radar recently, I thought, oh, this is awesome. These guys are killing it with these parody and satire stories. But actually, so I kid about your experiences, the three of you. Why don't you set the record straight, maybe start with Brian. Give listeners, Brian, an update about who you are and where you're at and what you're doing these days.
Sure thing, Greg. My name's Brian Lilly. I'm a field paramedic in a large metropolitan service in the Midwest. I blog over at edumedicblog.com, and I also co-host Medical Author Chat at medicalauthorchat.com.
Excellent. And recent change to the large urban area in the Midwest, is it – any highlights so far that you can share with us?
Oh, boy. So what Greg's referring to is I've been the training and clinical services manager for a smaller rural EMS system for several years, and then just recently made the transition to a large metropolitan area. And, boy, I don't know if I could get it all into a 30-second elevator speech, everything that's just rocked my world going from a metropolitan or from an rural area to a metropolitan area. It's really going to help me grow as a provider. It's just been awesome.
Okay, great. Well, maybe when you we'll have you back sometime in the future where you could list out what some of the highlights or lesson learned or challenges have been so far. David, you've got a pretty thick EMS resume. What do you do and what are you up to these days?
Well, I kind of, you'll throw all the balls in the fire there a little bit like we all do. But my primary profession, I oversee EMT, paramedic education, at Community College in East Tennessee. That's what I do. And we've got a really stellar program. And that's actually where I came into to cohorting with you on the show here and progressed along further. But I also blog a little bit at thecombomedic.blogspot.com. In addition to that, I do a little bit on the side here. In addition, do the EMS Educast Mini, where we bring shorter topics that don't have the full hour-long genre and do little 5, 10, 15-minute podcasts on a topic of your choice. So we're always looking for new topics to research and bring on the air. So if you have anything for that as well, simply send it to me and we'll get it put up on the air for you.
Excellent. David, I'm still smiling a little bit. I'm a big fan of the mixed metaphor, and you started out by talking about having lots of balls in the fire, and I can imagine that you can juggle lots of balls or you can have many irons in the fire, but I love the idea of juggling flaming tennis balls or bean bags or something, and imagine that makes you twice as busy.
That's yes. we can always see how that works. I mean, I'm actually a pretty good juggler. I haven't taken on the flaming balls yet, though.
Okay. Well, I'm a big fan of the mixed metaphor, and you served up a doozy there that made me smile. So, thanks for that. And Kevin Colopy, you've been on the Educast several times, but I think just live shows at EMS World. Have you ever been part of one of our sort of regularly recorded shows?
This is the first time I've been on one of the recorded shows.
Okay.
It's previously just been at Expo.
Okay, and we're looking forward to having you on the show at EMS World Expo next week. But why don't you give our listeners a little bit of an overview of who you are and what you do, because I know that, like David and Brian, you also have a lot of irons in the fire.
I guess a couple of them. So, like Greg said, I'm Kevin Colopy. I'm the Performance Improvement and Education Coordinator for an air and ground critical care transport team down in Wilmington, North Carolina. I also oversee the clinical research that we're performing there. And I am one of the co-authors for the monthly CE column in EMS World magazine, and also do a little bit of teaching at the college as well in the paramedic classroom. So I try and stay a little bit busy.
So lots of spinning plates there. Things on the to-do list for sure. Well, I think the four of us probably have that in common with a lot of our listeners that, it's always sort of something and maybe more opportunities than we can actually get done, but that maybe doesn't stop us from saying, sure, I can do that, or I'd be happy to try. But before we launch into tonight's topic, listeners, we just want to take a short pause to hear something from our sponsor, EMS Manager.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. They have been consistently helping EMS agencies save time and energy with their innovative web-based software for staff scheduling and management. There's a mobile web app accessible from smartphones or other mobile devices with an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web. You can check your own schedule, and managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere. One Indiana EMS service manager called scheduling a part-time job all by itself But with EMS Manager, he was able to schedule an entire month of coverage in just a few hours. That's a significant amount of time and money saving for services struggling to make ends meet. It's affordable, too. Pricing for EMS Manager is based on the size of your organization, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud, meaning there is no additional local IT cost to worry about. And there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. We would like to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast and other shows from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and the support of what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes and sign up for the free trial at emsmanager.net. Show them that you appreciate their support by trying out the software. Visit emsmanager.net for LADtech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workplace management. Let them know you heard it here on the EMS Educast. emsmanager.net.
Thanks for the support. So how we got here for this talk tonight, and it was initiated, we had a guest scheduled that needed to reschedule because of a family commitment that emerged at the last minute, and we're rescheduling him real soon. But I threw out there on the Facebook page, facebook.com/EMSEducast, where Facebook tells me that 505 people saw this, but I only got 2 likes and 2 comments. And Kevin, you said, how about a conversation on training and re-educating the experienced providers? So before Brian or David and I answer that or start a discussion about it, tell us a little bit more about what you're getting at with that question.
Well, it's really easy to think on, and there's a lot of research that has been put out there on the EMS classroom, effective learning, flipping the classroom, and how to really best capture the adult learners. If you think about paramedic education, though, anyone who stays in the field more than 3 to 5 years, 90% of your education comes after you get your paramedic certification or your paramedic license, depending on the state that you're in. For the vast majority of our paramedics that are out there, though, a lot of them think, especially those who have been doing it a while, that they understand everything they need to know to do their job. So you get a bunch of experienced providers, and you have to convince them that there's a lot more information they, one, need to learn, and two, that it's going to impact their job performance, and three, that it's going to impact patient outcomes. And it's important to understand how to reach out to those providers, especially people who have been in the field perhaps 15, 20 years, who have been doing the same thing for a while. What really got me thinking about it was Dr. Brian Bledsoe, who I'm sure everybody has heard of or knows, put a fantastic article out in the August edition of EMS World magazine, and it was talking about, and it was in succession to the position paper that was released by the National Association of EMS Physicians in conjunction with the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. And it really was a landmark paper basically saying the paradigm has shifted in spinal mobilization. It needs to be the exception rather than the rule now in trauma. And I was reading the blog of comments afterwards, and someone who had been in the field for a while essentially said, they've been doing this for 20, 25 years. Our job is to put a patient on a backboard, take him to the hospital, and let the emergency department worry about the rest. And completely missed the point on what you do in half an hour really can affect long-term care. And it got me thinking about, you know, I deal with the same things on a daily basis, working in an environment where my least experienced paramedic has been a paramedic for 6 years. My most experienced paramedic has been a paramedic longer than I've been alive. And I have to be able to find a way to reach out to both of them and convince them that, hey, the information we're talking about today is new and different and really can impact everything you've known up to this point. And it's okay to recognize that something has changed and that you're going to have to change your medicine a little bit.
So there's the question in the background. I certainly have a few things on my mind, but maybe I'll go to David or Brian first. One of you jump in here.
I'd be happy to jump in, Greg. It's Brian.
Go for it, Brian.
So I really do like this topic, and as I was thinking about it, today, I'm thinking about the opportunities that we have to really grab a paramedic, and we have their undivided attention for the purpose of retraining. And a couple came to mind. So to just maybe narrow the conversation a little bit, I was going to throw some of those out there, and you could go in any direction with any four of these. But what comes to mind is, you know, we have a real opportunity to train paramedics when we're first giving them their training during initial certification phase. And another time is during refresher training before they relicense. A third time that I'm thinking about is during any kind of retraining for a new job that they take on, and they go through another organization's academy. So now they're a new employee all over again. And then a fourth time would be for clinical remediation. Say they were deficient in a certain skill and they showed a pattern that was not productive, so they had remediation training. So I guess my thought would be to kind of look at, when do we really have the opportunity to get somebody's undivided attention to have meaningful discussion about retraining them? Is it during initial training, refresher training, remediation training, or new hire training when they go to another workplace? I would like to hear what you guys think about that.
I think that's a pretty interesting scheme, if you will, to sort of put to organize the training opportunities. I think the thing that I'm struggling with the most is just this sort of like premise that that it's up to me to grab their attention or to convince them that they need to know something, or that there's just the, you know, where's the motivation come from? And if, you know, if whenever I feel like I say, you need to know this, or that, like that, or you got to, you know, sort of climb out of the dark ages and know this new stuff, that it either puts people on defensive, that makes them defensive, or they focus in on just like, oh, you're right, give me that little factoid that I need to know and then I'm good, until you tell me what I need to know next. And between now and then, I'm just going to just keep on going with just what I have, and which I think is different than the mentality of what can I learn today? What's out there? What should I, how should I be improving? What did I learn yesterday? What do I want to do better tomorrow? That's the Greg, part of this I'm struggling with.
Greg, do you think that starts in historically the class, in the paramedic classroom? And I can speak based on my paramedic education, that what was taught to us was taught as gospel, that it is the truth, when in reality, much of it was dogma and sacred cows. You know, it's the way we've always done it, but it was presented in a matter of, instead of this is what we know now, it was, we know this, this is the truth, this is fact, when in reality, there was no science behind it. And as we've driven as an industry towards science-based medicine, we've learned that a lot of the quotes, this is what we know, we're now finding out of, oh, you know what, we made a mistake, and now we've got to go back to that 15, 20-year provider and say, guess what? It's not that you're wrong or that you were doing this wrong. It's what we thought was best practice, but we're now learning there's a better practice.
What do you have to say about that, David?
Well, that's what I was going to get to. One of the things that I've heard so far, and I believe Kevin was the one that mentioned it, is the fact that this is a service-wide, profession-wide paradigm shift, and the fact that we're having to look at where we are going and what we want to do when we get there. So we talked about this. We've already made mention that we've gone to evidence-based medicine, and medicine is a practice, and we know that because things change on a daily basis. But what have we done for years? You look at a lot of places, their continuing education program has been ACLS and PALS and PHTLS or ITLS or some trauma program, and what do? We do the refresher, and it's supposed to be an eight-hour class, and people like try to rush it, get it done in 4 hours. So ultimately, we've had this easy class taught to us really quick, and now we're saying we're going to change your mind. We're introducing this new stuff, this new things that are coming out, and we see, you know, we've all seen something that works. We see something that works, and one of the things I can use as an example is the Trendelenburg position. You know, how many people to this day still fight saying the Trendelenburg position works? And when you ask them, well, what did you do? Well, I put them in the Trendelenburg position. Blood pressure went up. So it obviously worked. Well, what else did you do? Well, I kept them warm. I started IV fluids, started dopamine, and elevated their feet all at the same time. Well, yeah, his blood pressure is going to go up. You've refilled. So now we're having to change that mentality. Why is this not working? And we've got to challenge our people and show them why. And, I mean, we've got to get down into our own services out in the field saying, these are the numbers. This is what we see. This is the improvement because we went to this in return of spontaneous circulation or some of this other stuff. Now, we can challenge those starting at the very, very beginning of these people's career, bring those EMTs out there and making sure that as we teach them, we don't teach them the shortcuts that are learned out in the field, the things that ultimately can cause issues in people's career. And as these experienced providers start to see this new education plan come out, professional development plan come out, they're also seeing these new people, and they're going to pick up these habits at some point in time. And ultimately, this sleeping giant turns around and changes. But it's a holistic approach that you've got to take to it.
Okay, so I'm kind of thinking about playing devil's advocate here, and I know that you guys are kind of coming from an education standpoint, and with me coming from a field perspective, I'm thinking that if a new paramedic comes into a larger system, just the odds alone of them being able to affect the practices of some of the veteran paramedics are fairly low. I mean, they really have to have the stars aligned before they can influence in their inexperience the practices of somebody who is very comfortable with their experience, their high level of experience. And when I'm thinking about retraining the experienced provider, I'm thinking about taking a paramedic who has been in the field for 10 years already and is already very comfortable in what they know and what they do, and then having to retrain them. And that's probably not going to happen in a refresher class because of the things that you brought up, that, you know, they're supposed to go for X number of hours, and people are, you know, asking, hey, are we going to get out early today? You know, before you're even to 9 a.m. And I think we've all seen that happen. So those probably aren't going to happen in a refresher class. It's certainly not going to happen in an ACLS class. You know, I'm kind of left to ask myself, what's the carrot that is out in front of that experienced provider to take responsibility for changing themselves? Is it something as drastic as in my EMS system, where if capnography is not placed on an intubated patient within X number of seconds after intubation, then you're facing a 30-day unpaid leave of absence? Is it something that drastic, or is it something that is a little bit more, how do I say this?
Less punitive.
Yeah, less punitive. Is it something that's more educational but still tied to some consequences if they choose not to use those educational opportunities? I think once you have a provider who is very comfortable with where they're at, the motivation for them is going to be very different than the people who say Greg sees at one of the conferences, who attends one of his lectures, and these people want to learn, and their motivations are there for self-improvement. And unfortunately, that's probably not the average EMS provider. I think the average EMS provider is doing great work as best they know how in the communities that they love, and there's nothing wrong with that. But they're probably not the same as the ones that are paying the money to drive long distances to conferences to better themselves. And I'm thinking about really realistic ways that we can motivate the average paramedic or EMT to adopt new practices after 10 years. And I think that's a really tough question, but I think it's probably the first question to ask. How do you motivate somebody like that? Because if you try to get them in the classroom to change the foundation of their practice and they're not motivated and they don't see the reason, well, you've kind of pulled the pin on your own grenade there.
So are any of you guys familiar with Just Culture?
Oh, absolutely.
Way up.
So have you seen it be successfully applied to EMS organizations? Because I think a lot of this ties into what can be used as a just culture in education and in progression in an organization.
If I could jump in there, I got a couple of thoughts on that.
I've got an example from our program, but I'd like to hear what you've got to say first.
Well, go ahead with your example.
Well, so you brought up capnography and someone getting suspended, or the potential of that. That would be something that's very punitive and not just culture. And in USO, how do you entice and carrot someone, and you take that 15, 30-year provider and make them, if any of us stand up in front of them and tell them, you need to change your practice, you need to do this, you need to do this, and here's the, we could throw all the data up there, we wanted it, we've shut them off already as soon as we started with you need to. What if you take that same provider, and so they forgot to put capnography on a patient. Say they forgot it for the entire transport, it was bad. And you're trying to impress upon them, you know what the state says, and this is something that has happened at our organization. Not only is it a departmental policy, but the state has actually said you must do this. So you challenge them and you guide them through going through the research and, well, let's look at all the things we can do with capnography to understand why it's important. And then they get to be the ones that stand up there in the front of everyone and present that information. Now they're still, as the 15, 20-year provider, the subject matter expert. They're still, instead of the same person standing up there all the time, their seasoned provider, their peer, whom hopefully the other staff respect and look up to, is now in front of them sharing this new information, and it looks like it's their idea rather than the educator of the programs.
Yeah, I think that the folks at Outcomes Engineering have come up with a wonderful product in Just Culture. In my previous organization, we used it. I really do like it for about 75% of what managers in EMS have to deal with. And that this is just my personal opinion. But a lot of the stuff that you have to deal with as an EMS manager, issues like uniform appearance, issues such as documentation, issues like using a backer so that you don't put excessive dents or scratches in the ambulance, fairly easy to correct type things where nobody's going to suffer large consequences one way or the other. The Just Culture works great. In a small percentage of really, really high risk, low frequency cases, the medical directors that I've talked to have kind of shied away from Just Culture because, in their words, how often do we need to remediate an esophageal intubation? How often do we need to remediate unrecognized onset of VTAC? And in their estimation, when I talked with people at the Just Culture conferences that we had in the state of Missouri, the medical directors were just thinking, you know, I just feel like for some of these cases, Just Culture wasn't a sufficient algorithm. And that was their response, and I tended to agree with them on some of the more severe cases. But I do think that for the majority of what EMS managers deal with on a day-to-day basis, which is largely behavioral, I think Just Culture works really well.
Can it not work educationally? Sure, you gave two great examples of where it's probably in an extreme situation, recognizing a lethal dysrhythmia. That's that's the core of being a paramedic. If you're not doing that, if you can't do that, you're either not paying attention to your patient or your monitor, or you're behind the eight ball. But if it's something that's new information, new technology, new medicine, and we've failed as educators to help them understand the true importance of it, that capnography is the same thing. You just tell everyone who's been intubated and managing areas for years, you now have to put waveform capnography on 100% of these. No exceptions. But you don't teach them the art of how it's beneficial and why have we set them up for success. And if it is a low frequency, high risk event, even needle chest decompression, but you haven't been practicing that. And what ties into this nicely is there was just a study released that said for some of these low frequency, high risk skills, you need to be practicing them every 6 months or potentially every quarter to maintain some level of proficiency. If you're not doing that within your agency, and we've got that kind of data out there as an educator, are we truly setting up our provider for success? And that's where I think just culture falls into it of not, I don't want to say we need to be, never be punitive if something's truly warranting punitive reaction, but if we're looking at how to incentivize someone to want to learn more, just culture may have a place in that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. Absolutely.
I guess I perhaps don't know enough about it, but I would wonder, I think it's an all or nothing approach that you're either going to have a just culture or you're not going to. If there's a gray area or in certain cases you risk, if the medical director has the latitude to decide, oh, this is an instance where, yes, we should not apply the just culture here principles and we should punish, then that just sort of turns the whole thing into high stakes of uncertainty. And then I guess I would also turn it around of, if there's a risk that one of the providers you're responsible for is going to intubate the esophagus, isn't that a training issue? Like, or why do we even have that in our scope? Like, why would you give somebody the opportunity to fail catastrophically? Where the not only are the consequences severe for the patient, but severe for the provider. Like, why even give them the chance to fail catastrophically, routinely, you know?
Like, and Greg, that question is exactly what just culture is that it has an algorithm that the very end of it would be that provider is at fault. They will be held accountable. But the first step is, did you set them up for success? Did you give them the equipment to be successful? The second question is, did you train them how to use that equipment? The third question might be, does their leadership and administration support the routine use of that equipment and make sure it's readily accessible operationally? The fourth might be, was it an honest mistake? And the last might be, if all else, then it's their fault. They just didn't do it. And that's, well, that's glossing it over very roughly, but...
Well, that's what I was looking at as we were talking. I pulled up a presentation from the health department in New York, and it talking about just culture, and it's got a slide on here that I really think is kind of interesting because it breaks out basically taking everything that we've just said into three boxes and put ultimately three levels, and we've got just human error, at-risk behavior, and then reckless behavior. And if it's a human error, it mentions an inadvertent action, a slip, lapse, or mistake. We're going to console and kind of build that up through additional training, you know, and such. At risk behavior where they didn't recognize something, why, you know, so all the way up to the punitive action, the punishment where there's reckless behavior, there's actually a punishment associated with it. And we can build that in as we develop plans for, educating these experienced providers, bring them in to why we're doing this. Hey, we've seen a large issue with this, we've had a higher incidence of infections secondary to IV initiation, and we're seeing this kind of issue. you know, we've identified something and we're fixing it. And you can train that, and, you know, as long as you tie it back to this is why it is, I think that's one of the ways that we can get those people to buy in to changing the way they have been doing things for years.
So let me give you guys this example, because this is something that I'm continuing to struggle with at my program. We do a combined. I've got everything from an intermediate ambulance. We do some 911, and then we do ground and air critical care, scene and inner facility for both. When I arrived at the program, everything was 100% oxygen. If you put a patient on a ventilator, they're going to get 100% oxygen, and you might titrate it back if you get a chance to during transport. But if you don't worry about it. All your STEMI patients, your traumas, anything, any potential instability, they got 100% oxygen. The data out there says quite clearly that that's dangerous. So one of my big pushes on performance improvement has been limiting oxygen administration to just what's necessary for the patient. We've got we can run arterial blood gases during transport. We've got the technology to do that. We've obviously got pulse oximeters. You've got all the information you need to set it up appropriately. So we did a training and talked about oxygen toxicity and how even in a short-term transport you can make a difference. Presented the data on in STEMI patients, 5 minutes of 100% oxygen reduces cerebral or coronary artery perfusion by 40%. So in a STEMI, in 5 minutes of high flow oxygen, you can make a difference. I changed all the protocols when we did protocol updates to starting on 50 to 60% oxygen, which is a safe range. I still have providers who use 100% oxygen all the time. But we had to go through the process of to effect change. Well, I can't hold you accountable, even though we've trained on it, when the protocol says start at 100% oxygen. And a just culture would say, I can't, as a PI person, flag your chart, perform QA with you when the protocol doesn't support what we're trying to affect and change, so we had to wait to make that change. But now we're at the point we've made all the changes, we've gone through just culture, and now I need to ask myself, at what point do I start saying, you know, you're harming this patient by keeping him on an unbreathed breather? But that's a real paradigm shift, and I'm holding back because, wow, is that a huge paradigm change in our industry to say a non-rebreather breather is dangerous.
Well, and one of the other things, and this ties into a conversation that I've had here recently, some of these very seasoned individuals that have been around for a large number of years, one of the things that we're seeing now in the field is something that was great in the past, used it all the time, then it went out of favor, and now we're seeing those come back. So those individuals now are going, well, why did we ever get rid of it? You know, so there's some of those things that have been good in the past that have gone and now are coming back. And so some of these longer-term individuals are seeing that, and then that will then make it even tougher for them next time you say, well, this isn't working, we've got to get rid of it.
Kevin, the two things that come to mind for me is that knowledge change never equals behavior change, or there's some lag. And you know, next week at EMS World, I'm going to be talking about distraction, and we'll specifically dig in a little bit to driving while distracted. And most people know that their increased risk of a collision when they're trying to text or talk on the phone. They have the knowledge, but that doesn't change their behavior. And then the related thing is that you can equate a series of near failures with somehow success or special powers. Or so if you repeatedly drive down the highway and use the cell phone and never have a failure, a crash, or you repeatedly give a patient oxygen and they don't get worse, or you're not around because you only spent 15 minutes with them to see the consequences of that action, you interpret your actions, your near failures, you normalize that and say, well, somehow that doesn't apply to me or my patients, or I have special powers that other people driving and texting don't seem to have. So that so much of what we do as EMS providers especially happens in a real vacuum. If you have a very short, even a critical care provider in the grand scheme of things, if you spend 2 hours with a major trauma patient that then has a 60-day hospitalization and then another 6 months of rehab, your 2 hours was just a fraction. But you have no way of knowing, in most situations, the outcome for that patient or if anything you did made any positive or negative difference. So I think that exacerbates the disconnect between knowledge change and behavior change.
You're absolutely right, and it's showing that, and we're unique and have the benefit of being hospital affiliated. I can go back and I can show how we did or did not make a difference, whether it's a medicine or a skill or intervention. But you're right, that provider that puts that 80-year-old patient who fell down the stairs on a backboard, waits 20 minutes after a 15, 20-minute ride to the emergency department, waits those 20 minutes for a bed. Now the patient's been 40 minutes, another 5, 10 minutes to see the doctor, 45, 50 minutes on a backboard. That patient could have a decubitus ulcer by that point. But they don't see that because they saw the patient got taken off as soon as they got to the emergency department and saw a doctor, didn't stay there long enough to see the assessment. And oftentimes there's poor communication back to the educators and the PI people at their, or their QA coordinators or whatever they're called at their ambulance service to say, hey, did you know? So there's no connection that really does make a difference because they don't hear about it in the after actions.
That Kevin just mentioned has been one of my kind of pet peeves in a non-hospital environment, is that especially the majority of my career in the field was spent as a fire medic with the fire department and non-transport fire department. So we would do first response and pass off to a transport EMS agency. And the amount of time that we would actually get information back about our patients was very slim to none, and only when we actually rode in and assisted in the treatment up until getting into the emergency department. So ultimately we may see something that we do provide a positive result in that 5 minutes that we have them, and then 10 minutes down the road, it was completely detrimental and we had no feedback on that. Which is why, you know, when we have challenging cases, I'd love for some of these places that have non-hospital affiliated services actually get together and do something similar to what they used to do, or in some hospitals still do, like the morbidity and mortality conferences where, you know, the treating individuals would get together and present, and then they would find where things went in error. But we would never find out what happened 10 minutes after we drop the patient off, and that can be detrimental because we don't see how our care affected them.
Hopefully, as we switch to outcomes-based medicine, and now that hospitals are going to get pay for performance, they're going to have a greater incentive to reach out to some of the EMS services that they interact with on a regular basis to share some of that information, to say, hey, you know what you do does make a difference, and here's how it's making a difference, because here's how it's affecting our reimbursement. And eventually I do see that also trickling down to EMS services, that we're going to all be required to report quality indicators at some level, and that's going to affect our Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement levels.
Brian, I'm trying to think through this, like, really from an education perspective and your sort of four education opportunities, and how do you help a provider appreciate their role in the continuum of care, in any given, in any one of those sort of four opportunities.
Okay, so the outcome engineering product, the Just Culture, I've said, you know, it's not a perfect system, but it is absolutely probably the best that we have in EMS, and in some of these at-risk behavior or reckless error or reckless behavior algorithms, we end up either taking a coaching role or maybe a punitive role, depending on where it falls. And you know, how do we motivate these people? How do we get them engaged in a coaching relationship once they have found themselves at this point in the just culture algorithm, and they need to be coached. And I think, is that kind of what I'm understanding, Greg?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of it just more, what's the specific activity that I could do? I think David's mention of morbidity and mortality report, or you know, just some sort of appreciation for that there's some ongoing care that happens, and that area of medicine is just as dynamic, if not more dynamic, than emergency medicine. You know, maybe it could be something just as simple as, you know, what are the innovations in cardiac rehab? You know, some sort of like overview of like, you know, the people that are, you know, nurses that are working on a cardiac rehab floor, what things have they had to stop doing and start doing in the last 5 years? Or somebody that's doing, you know, physical therapy and occupational therapy for major trauma patients, like those professions aren't any more dynamic or static than ours is. So how do you bring some of that in as maybe a parallel to appreciate that we shouldn't be stuck with our feet in the sand? Yeah. And how we assess and treat patients.
I think that's a great question. I don't have a really good answer to it, and maybe David does, but I do have some thoughts on how we create the environment for it.
Yeah, go ahead, and maybe this will be your final thought, and then we'll each give Kevin and David a final thought as well before we get to recommendations.
My final thought in a nutshell goes back to, you know, how I learned to coach and interact with kids that I've had the opportunity to mentor with. And I've always found that kids are always asking two basic questions. Do you love me? And can I have my own way? Do you love me? Yes, absolutely. We love them. Can they have their own way? No, we've got to set up some boundaries. And EMS providers are not children, so we don't want to treat them as such, but they have some very similar needs, and they're asking, am I valued, and are there boundaries? And we, as educators or field training officers or managers, we need to be able to say, are you valued? Yes, you are valued. Can you have your own way? Not all the time. There are boundaries, and here are those boundaries. And if we can consistently create a retraining environment where they understand that they are valued and that we want them there and what they are doing matters to us, they feel safe, they're more likely to learn, and they also understand the boundaries better. They understand the structure of the atmosphere that they work in better when we can do that, and I think it creates a framework for them to be more productive. So that's kind of in a nutshell my final thoughts, just going back to that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's a very basic thing. It's not a real sexy idea. The just culture stuff is cutting edge, and it's something that managers want to grab and just, yeah, let's run with this. But I think it's important to not forget those foundational needs that so many of our employees and providers have.
Yeah, work is the thing you spend doing more than any other thing, and it's good to be appreciated when you're there.
Yeah.
David, how about you? Final thought?
The biggest thing that we've talked about tonight and that I see is that this is not an overnight fix, and it's not something we need to do by ourselves. You know, get together a group like this, you know, from across the country and find out what is going on. Learn more about others that may be slightly more progressive than you. Work together and utilize some of the stuff like Kevin said. The pay for performance is coming. You know, let's integrate that stuff now. and we'll see an overall growth and development in our long-term we'll see long-term changes, and we may not be able to retrain everybody in some of these new areas. We may just develop these individuals and develop an educational program that tells these individuals that, hey, we're giving you what is proven to work right now. This is the evidence that we see, you know, be strong with curriculum development, developing stuff, and just say, hey, this is a constantly evolving thing. Research is going on and on and on every day. Know that next month you get out there in the field and something we've just taught you is the basic foundation may change. Oxygen therapy was one of the biggest things that for years was 100% all the time, great to go. Now that's not the same. So create that mentality from day one that change is coming, whether you want to see it or not, and build that up from the beginning. And then by the time you get to the those individuals being 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 year providers, they're ready to see that change and they embrace it a little bit better.
Thanks, David. How about you, Kevin? A final thought?
Two things off of what you guys just said. One, you're absolutely right in coaching from the beginning, that change is inevitable and it's constant, and we can't stop changing, and that's something that needs to be emphasized in every system. If you're doing the same medicine and you were 5 years ago, there's probably something wrong if nothing's changed in the practice. And we need to, as an industry, just be constantly ready for the regular level and a high level of change that's taking place, because we need to regularly be updating and changing as the science changes with us. And the other piece to it would be, And I found this and learned this myself, is when you're dealing with those experienced providers, make sure you understand where they're coming from. Because as much as we can say to them, here's the data, here's the science, here's the evidence, if we're just putting it in front of them and presenting it to them and telling them they need to know this, we might not understand why they're so passionate about the way it's been presented to them. It may have been an educator that they look up to, that they hold up on a pedestal, and they just can't believe that that person might have been wrong. It may have been that they had a personal experience that has them believing a different direction. We don't know what it is if we haven't asked that person. So tell me, why it is you're practicing medicine this way? What is it that you understand to be true? And if we understand what their viewpoint is and what their vantage point is, we might be able to more easily affect their change.
I think those are all excellent points. I would, one sort of final thought for me is that I would retire the phrase retraining or re-education, retire that from your lexicon, and try to adopt something like continuous learning. There's just, at least for my years, there's a negative connotation with retraining that sort of immediately puts me on the defensive. But it could just be that I'm pretty sensitive. Guys, this has been a real fun conversation. Brian and David, so good to have you back on the show. Kevin as well. Kevin, we'll see you next week at EMS World Expo. Kevin, if before we get to recommendations, if listeners want to connect with you, where can they find you on the internet?
I'm on LinkedIn. LinkedIn.com/ K as in Kevin, T as in Tom, Colloquy, C-O-L-L-O-P-Y. I'm also available via email at kevin.colloquy@nhrmc.org. That's for New Hanover Regional Medical Center, NHRMC.
Excellent. So if you just email me those, and I'll put those in the show notes. Brian, if listeners want to connect with you, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter, at Edumedic, that's at EDUMEDIC, or at my website, edumedicblog.com.
Excellent. David?
Facebook.com/DSBLEV. You can find me on Twitter with the same vanity tag, thanks to Greg Fries that got me in the vanity tag world. also here on the EMS Educast with the Educast Mini Edition.
Excellent. Well, guys, thanks so much. And so we like to wrap up the show with the recommendations, things that you think other EMS educators around the world might be interested. Maybe it's a book, an app, some piece of software, an event, something that you just want to share. So does anybody want to kick us off?
I would recommend everybody get one good full night's sleep a week. I run into too many providers and educators who aren't getting that. So that's my recommendation. Get one good night of sleep a week.
Well, that's an awesome recommendation. And I would add to it, study the effects of sleep deprivation and fatigue and how that affects not only work performance, but life performance. And yes, we all need to sleep more for sure.
I just need Brian to come here, if he would, talk to my kids and let them know that that is a vital thing for their parents to sleep.
Yeah.
That's going to be my contribution to the world. If I ever can figure out pharmacology, I will make a sleep pill. Not a sleeping pill, but a pill of sleep. And that's how you can catch up on your sleep. You can just take 2 hours of sleep.
Take two of these and call me in the morning.
Exactly.
David, how about you? Do you have a recommendation or endorsement for us?
Right now, I'm going to tell you, and I know you're a Kindle Fire guy, but I'm telling you that I am a big fan of the iPad Mini okay. right now. We have found, my school has me testing one out, and we have found that they, just about every situation, one of my faculty members is, they're studying to become private pilots to fly their little airplane around, and looking at nav maps on there, great for the ambulance, just great to have around. And I mean, I've got study stuff on here for EMS. I got podcasts, including the EMS Educast, and books galore. So love the iPad Mini right now.
Excellent. And Kevin, do you have a recommendation or an endorsement?
Anyone that wants to encourage someone to see what more information that is out there, especially if you have an experienced 911 provider that hasn't expanded, that hasn't gotten into any sort of critical care medicine, take a look at therescueshop.com. That's theresqshop.com. It's a website that's driven by a CRNA out of the Southwest, who's an absolutely brilliant educator, has 23 hours of online videos that are available, as well as his textbook, and has information and education that will just blow any provider's mind away that's out there.
Excellent. Send me that link as well. I want to talk about a community that their cardiac arrest survival rate, and we started the conversation about tonight. We mentioned the Call the Cops parody blog, and many people would hear a headline that would say, you know, cardiac arrest survival rate now tops 57%. Cardiac arrest survivors have a 1 in 2 chance of surviving, and thinking that that is somehow satire. But this is fact. It's happening in Seattle and King County. They've doubled their cardiac arrest survival from 26% in 2002 to 57, more than doubled, to 57% in 2012. And it's this sort of press release from today, September 4th, is sort of jaw-dropping, 6 lines of text when you think about the system they've built and how laser-focused they've become on this one facet of EMS, and just to sort of, it's amazing. And and then the sort of natural thing is to say, well, when they say 57%, what do they really mean? Is that only witnessed VFib or VTAC? And you can go and read their full cardiac arrest statistics. They have a 99-page annual report for the King County Medic One. I've seen some annual reports for very large services that you know, go all of like 1 or 2 pages, or maybe 3 if they've got some run volume statistics. But there's 99 pages here of really incredible accomplishments, including a table that breaks down survival to hospital discharge based on what the arrest rhythm was, if it was known or not, before arrival of EMS as well as after arrival of EMS. And then this also is another just jaw-dropping for me. CPR initiated by bystanders in all cases of CPR in King County in the year 2012 was 66%. And that speaks to a comprehensive effort of public education, dispatcher-provided instructions, and really a community ethos of we're going to make a difference here, and we're going to do all we can, because then once help arrived, we have really highly trained and skilled help to continue that care right on through survival to hospital discharge. So, you know, it, like we talked about with when Bill Toon shared his airway management instruction in Johnson County, equally jaw-dropping. Whenever you might hear something like that and say, well, that can't be done in my county or my service or my city, we couldn't do that here. Remember, I will always reply to you with, you're right, you can't do it. But if you could, how would you? And that will start your wheels turning and put you on some pathway to do it. So go forth, conquer, look at what they're doing in King County and Johnson County, and accomplish something amazing in your community. You're totally capable of it. And the cool part is a lot of people have already figured it out, so you just got to figure out how to take what they're doing and put it into place in your community. So there'll be links for those reports and more in the show notes. On behalf of regular co-hosts Rob Terrio and Bill Toon, big thank yous from me, Greg Fries, for David Blevins, Kevin Colpe, and Brian Lilly. Say hi to us at EMS World Expo and connect with us at facebook.com/EMSEdcast.